Managing Violence Podcast, episode 86. We're talking security industry defensive tactics with Nick Wyborn. The Managing Violence Podcast is proud to be partnered with Fuji Sports. Fuji Sports manufactures the highest quality of judo, jiu-jitsu, and MMA gear. Everything from gis to rashis, shorts, gloves, pads, bags, mats, finger tape, everything you could possibly need for training. I've personally been a customer and supporter of Fuji Sports dating back to my very first BJJ gi in 2007. Since then, they've been a go-to brand for me, whether I was chasing judo gear, BJJ gear, MMA gear, or just convenient bags to carry everything around in. The gi I wear to Krav Maga training now is actually a Fuji Sakai. It's one of the most comfortable and most durable gis I've ever owned. And yes, they even come in black for the ninjas in the audience. As a listener of the show, simply enter the discount code MVP10 at checkout for 10% off your order, and a percentage of the sale will also go to the show to keep us on the air. Savings for you, commission for us. What's not to love about that? MVP10 for 10% off at fujisports.com or fujisports.com.au for the Aussies. Some exclusions apply. Thank you, Fuji Sports, for years of high-quality gear and for supporting the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Managing Violence Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Saunders. On this show, we seek to equip you with the knowledge and skills to be able to manage violence, no matter who you are. We are hashtag for the protectors. If you are a protector by mindset, a protector by profession, or a protector in any other way, we are here for you. And speaking of protectors, my guest today is Mr. Nicholas Wyborn. Nick has a long career both in the security industry, in law enforcement, and then back in the private sector as well. Nick has a lot of insight coming from a martial artist into real world violence and how that transition happened for him. And some of the learnings he had coming from the private security industry into law enforcement and then back into the private sector. He's written a fantastic book for security professionals called Defensive Tactics for Security Professionals. And we're going to be talking a lot about that book. If you like the show, please remember you can get bonus content for this and every other episode at patreon.com/managing violence, or you can buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/JoeMVP. Don't forget, my book is also available on Amazon. Neon Jungle, A Bouncer's True Tales of Lessons, Laughs, and Lacerations. Yes, I almost forgot the title of my own book. Perhaps too many head knocks. Anyway, here we go with the interview with Mr. Nicholas Wyborn. I'm joined here on the Managing Violence Podcast by Nick Wyborn. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Joe. Real pleasure.
Mate, it is a unusual situation to have someone on the podcast in the same time zone as me. So for both of us, it is early morning, nearly always. It's me early morning, someone else's afternoon, or me late at night, someone else's morning. It's pleasant to speak to a fellow Aussie who's only a couple hundred kilometers away. So, thanks for indulging me, I guess, into not having to do complicated time zone calculations.
Oh, you're welcome.
Nick, you and I have known each other for, probably over a decade through various seminars and courses and things that we were both part of. You were kind enough to send me a copy of your book, which is Defensive Tactics for Security Professionals, which came out just recently during the lockdown, or the COVID quarantine lockdown period in history, where many people started podcasts and wrote books because suddenly people had extra time. So it should be a prolific time in human history of the amount of stuff that's been created, hopefully. But Nick, the whole focus of the conversation for today is going to be talking about defensive tactics in the security industry, and in particular in the context of the Australian security industry, as we were talking offline about. It is slightly different in a country like Australia versus perhaps the US. We probably have more in common with countries like the UK and maybe Canada, where there's similar sort of legal structures in place. But that said, I think there's a lot of value that we can sort of dive into when it comes to defensive tactics for what we call enforcement professionals who don't have as much authority as perhaps a law enforcement officer does. So that's probably what we'll talk about for the majority of the conversation. But let's start off with an introduction to you. What's your journey into this space? What's your background that led to you writing the book?
Yeah, sure. Joe, I started martial arts quite young. I think I was about 11 or 12 at the time. Boxing, I think, was first on the list. And I remember very early on being put in the ring with a 19-year-old. I think I was about 11 or 12 and course, I got knocked out, and I learned a lot from that. But I thought, yeah, not real keen on getting knocked out. So turned to martial arts, started exploring the martial arts, and I originally found Taekwondo and a couple other things along that vein. Took me to about 18 when I started working as a doorman, as a bouncer, and worked out quickly that the skills that I'd learned were not transferable to the work that I was doing. And that all, I guess, culminated in one incident that happened in a local nightclub where I was pinned in an alcove. And I think I write about it in the book. And I realized in that point in time that I had very little skills to deal with that threat in that moment. And that was kind of a life-defining moment right there. So I then went out and began a journey of searching for, more relevant tactics and techniques. And, I guess my career just kind of followed suit. I joined the police force, New South Wales Police Force, when I was 23. Still quite young, fairly naive, but had a pretty good skill set kind of going in, which is I'd done some training with the ISR and some combatives and a few other things. So had a really good career in law enforcement, was quite fortunate to get into a specialist unit called the Weapons and Tactics Training Unit, which was based out of Golden Police Academy, which is the largest police academy in Australia. And I learned a lot in that role. I learned a lot from senior guys ahead of me, guys from the TAU and things like that. And very early on, I think it was maybe my first year in the job, I traveled to the US just wanting more. And I did some really good training in the US around 2010. Came back and was lucky to become a weapons and tactics trainer. And went back to the US again, learned some other good stuff. I left the police after about 5 and a bit years. And I had a little bit of, as I mentioned, security experience before that. So went back to doing a little bit of security, became a security trainer, and kind of been doing that for a few years. And I guess the rest is history. I've had some other things that I've been doing. I was in the military for about a minute, spent about 9 months in the Australian Army Reserve, and then started my business. So started a gym and a martial arts center, and went from being quite free and flexible to, then working 100 hours a week for myself. So no time to parade or do anything. So but fast forward to today, I still run a martial arts studio. I teach a system called CAPAP under Major Avi Nadia, over in the US, and also a on-call firefighter, which I quite enjoy.
Awesome, man. There's a lot to unpack there, but I'd like to go back to that first learning curve of going from being sort of, I guess, recreational martial artist to 18 years old on the doors. All of a sudden, this is real life. You actually have to apply this stuff, and you're identifying training gaps in real time. And I mean, your story and my story are very, very similar in that aspect. And to me, it was that time working on the doors that opened my eyes to all the things that I didn't yet know about how to manage violence. But let's talk a little bit first, before we go into the gaps in your martial arts, talk us through what the actual defensive tactics training was to get your security license, to become a security guard. Because a lot of people are probably oblivious to what that training looks like. So what was that experience for you? What was that training for you?
Look, I think at the time, in New South Wales, I think the security course was about 1 week. I didn't do any defensive tactics training whatsoever before working the door. So it was kind of like bringing lambs to the slaughter, so to speak. Absolutely zero. I had some really, really great instructors at the time in the industry, and it was no discredit to them. Just the way that the training packages were set up, they were very theory-based, theory-heavy, and there was just no defensive tactics at that time.
Yeah, you and I came in around about the same time, or about the same age, and got into the industry around the same time. I was in Queensland, and my defensive tactics training was 1 day, and I believe we covered a transport wrist lock, or the gooseneck wrist lock, as some might know it. We covered a straight armbar escort, And we covered a shoulder pin, or the lateral vascular neck restraint, I think, in the literature, which is a standing arm triangle for anyone who might know that terminology better. And that was basically it. And we had a palm heel strike to the sternum. We had a hit and spin, and that was basically it. So, and realistically, we had a whole day. One day. So probably about 4 hours of actual training in between the theory and a whole bunch of uncoordinated gimps that really couldn't do it anyway. So unless you had an actual background in martial arts or in the ability to defend yourself in some way, whether it's just you grew up scrappy or whatever, that course did very little to prepare you for the reality of working on a door. If you're going to work at an airport or work at in loss prevention or something where you're just literally observing and reporting, then it probably would have been sufficient. But if you're going out to work in a nightclub or a pub environment where you're going to be dealing with angry people, then the training was pretty much nil. So for you, I mean, you came in basically with a kickboxing skill set, right? With Taekwondo, a bit of boxing, some striking martial arts. Had you started doing Japanese Jiu-Jitsu at that point?
No, not back then.
Cool. So you basically had a lot of striking skills. How did you find, what were the gaps that you identified when you started dealing with real violence, having come from that background?
Yeah, look, certainly the emotion. I had never been taught to deal with the emotion of violence. So I remember that hitting me quite hard. I remember being on the door and being that nervous that, my knee would shake, physically, my knee would tremble, and, several times where, I did fear for my life. We had bikies and things in at the time, and, I just had very little skills that helped me deal with that. It was more the intent of violence, the intent of somebody truly wanting to hurt you or kill you. There's nothing that had prepared me that up until that point. So that was probably the biggest shock, was the psychological shock of it all, trying to think and function, in that environment. And I guess adrenaline, can be your best friend sometimes. But there was certainly a lack of skill and knowledge in that area at that time.
So how did you overcome that? I mean, did you have a mentor who could help you with it? Is it something you just decided to try and battle on your own? Like, how did you overcome that fear?
Yeah, I think initially, Joe, I had I did have some skills that I had attained from quite a different area, I guess. If I could paint a bit of a picture, I was born quite sick as a child. I was born 11 and a half weeks premature. I weighed 2 pounds 14 ounces. The pneumothorax, collapsed lung, and a few other things. So I was quite a very sick baby. Was lucky to even see this world initially to begin with. My mother nearly died on the table having me. So as a child, I developed asthma from a very early age, bronchitis. And as a toddler going through childhood, would have regular asthma attacks. I was constantly attached to a nebulizer. I'd be taking, just had a horrible time basically as a child. And my poor mother and father, who must have been up every night with me, doing postural drainage and things like that, just to kind of help me breathe. And then as I started to get older, I started to realize that, certainly in my teens, that when I had an asthma attack, if I was out somewhere and had an asthma attack, generally what would happen is I would fall to the ground because I couldn't breathe. I'd start to hyperventilate, and then it would require an adult to come and take me back to get either my medication or to the hospital, whichever was nearer. But as I started to get a bit older, I started to realize that I had a little bit of control over myself. And I worked out that if I controlled my breathing just that little bit and kept my heart rate down, it would open up my prefrontal cortex, or the part of my brain that could help me think. And then I could make some sound decisions about getting to that phone booth or getting to that adult or parent over there who could then help provide me with that further care. So I guess I learned to regulate my own breathing and stay really, really calm from a very early age. And that all came from, I guess, being quite ill with those respiratory conditions.
It's interesting. It's such a common trope, some of the martial arts legends of our of our history that they start off with, oh, he was a sickly child. and it's just interesting how often that's repeated. What I'm curious about is, I mean, you and I probably have both seen in the security industry that the number of people that come in unprepared and they don't last 6 months, right? They spend $2,000 or $3,000 getting trained, getting licensed, you know, getting a job. And then the first time someone raises their voice at them and they realize, and they bottle it to use a UK term, and they can't live it down anymore. So they find a reason to go do something else. Now they go drive for Uber, or they find another gig that gets them out of that conflict zone. So, I mean, I'm curious for you, what was it that made you decide to stick around, even though obviously this was a fairly unpleasant experience often enough? Why stick around? You had other opportunities.
Yeah, I certainly did. I'd done a trade when I was quite young, and I had other opportunities, but I think that I enjoyed the challenge of testing myself. I certainly had a very deep calling to protect and serve, which has then transpired in other ways through my life. But I guess helping people has always been at the core of who I am and what I want to do. And I guess getting into the security industry was just a vehicle, or possibly the first vehicle that I found where I could actually do that.
Mm, very cool. Very cool. So let's have a fast forward a little bit. I mean, you leave the security industry, you go into law enforcement, you end up as a trainer, operational safety trainer, weapons and tactics, defensive tactics, whatever terminology our listeners are familiar with. You're training police officers and how to manage violent or resisting subjects. You've obviously expanded your own training through Japanese Jiu-Jitsu, ISR Matrix, CAPAP, other courses and seminars. You're one of the frequent faces on a seminar, no matter where in the country it was. I saw you regularly. There was always the core group of us that seemed to appear everywhere. Obviously you had a passion for learning. What were some of the interesting aspects as you went from being someone who was used to managing violence or confrontation in a security context to then transitioning to law enforcement? What were some of the things that were different for you in that space?
Yeah, look, I think initially starting in general duties, which is where every single police recruit begins, I felt fairly confident going and working in that environment. There were certainly new skills to learn, arms and appointments, tactical options, all those types of things. But I felt fairly confident in my own skill set and abilities at that time, and certainly my ability to communicate and de-escalate and so forth, where I found that not all of my peers possessed those same traits. So look, that certainly helped. But there was a divide, law enforcement work being quite different. You're in uncontrolled environments. You don't get to choose the location that you fight generally. That's dictated by the offenders. You don't get to dictate how many people are in those fights. And then of course, as I said, you've got all those other considerations, those arms and appointments and things like that to now consider. You've got to retain all those. You've got to think what happens if they're taken away from me. There's now a firearm at every single job that I go to because I bring it. So going from an unarmed situations in pubs and nightclubs where, the chance of someone being armed, probably not that great, to now working in law enforcement where there is the possibility of being shot at every single job you attend, hence why I wore a vest. So, it was different on many levels.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the extra resources as well, I mean, this is something that, was confronting to me when I was young in the security industry in particular, where you if you're working as part of a large team, you're working at a large venue where you've got 15, 20 guys on potentially if it's a really big place, versus when you're working completely on your own. there's no one is coming, and especially the, some of the places I worked, police were not prioritizing call outs to that particular venue. Right. And were quite happy to tell me they weren't prioritizing the call out to that venue because they knew who was involved and didn't really want to deal with it. So you've got to manage things on your own when you're in that security role, and maybe help will come. depending on your relationship with local police and, you know, how enthusiastic the duty manager is to actually call them, because quite often managers will, or venue management will resist calling the police for as long as possible because it doesn't look good for the reputation of the venue. So there's all those sort of complicating factors. I guess one of the things that I learned the hard way, I guess accidentally, was I worked at a venue that was really bad. Like it was really bad. And we used to pay special duties police to be there. So we had a an arrangement to between midnight and 3 a.m. We closed at 2 a.m. So between midnight and 3 a.m. we would have one paddy wagon and two cops that we paid for. That would be there literally just so that we didn't have to wait when we needed someone arrested. We could take them out, get them cuffed, get them thrown in the back of the paddy wagon. And that was kind of that, because we were just so often having assaults, serious, like whether it was trespass or whether it was serious assaults or whatever, right? It was just so frequent that we knew if we called the police, it was going to be half an hour, 40 minutes. So we'd have to restrain someone until they arrived. So if we just paid them to be there, then that was easier. But the benefit of that was also that if police called other police for backup, the response time was like 3 minutes as opposed to half an hour when we called them for backup. So that was a benefit that we kind of hacked the system a little bit by, we also built a good relationship with the local police then, because it was usually the same core group that were doing the special duties. And they started to get a little bit more familiar with us and the kind of crap we're dealing with. So there's a little bit more empathy or even sympathy for our role. But let's talk a little bit more about defensive tactics, because my experience and please correct me if it doesn't map to yours, but my experience was that the more useful guards that I worked with typically had some sort of background beforehand. Whether it be martial arts, even playing footy, playing rugby league, something like that, they're a little bit more comfortable with a bit of contact, they're comfortable with a bit of physicality. The problem was that in the security industry, in particular, the nightclub industry, it tends to be mostly young males, right? So most of our cohort are 18 to 30. By the time you get to 30, you start to wonder, like, why are you wasting your life here, right? But so you're mostly 18 to mid-20s probably. Testosterone's high, aggression's a bit high, and if your only skill set is either punching on a rugby field or kickboxing, for example, then you tend to get yourself into some legal trouble. Or at the very least, you have to answer some uncomfortable questions. What was your experience predominantly as a striker coming into those environments and navigating that risk?
Look, that's a great question, Joe. To this day, hand over heart, I can still say that I've never punched anyone operationally. Striking, even though my skill base was striking, it was not something that I relied upon ever. Really, obviously, moving into law enforcement and things, there were strikes that formed part of our defensive tactics training. But punching and kicking people and stuff, it's never been my way. I think the art in martial arts is being able to control the person without really doing them harm. And I guess that's very different to coming from a self-defense situation where you're defending your life or the life of a loved one. And I think I mentioned in the book the difference between fighting for control and fighting for your life. But certainly when fighting for control, which is, 99% of the time what you're doing in security and law enforcement, I don't believe there is really a need to do a lot of striking. I've managed to get through without it, quite well. Mm. There is a time and a place to use those distraction techniques, but I think the real skill in the art is in being able to control the person without doing them harm. And I mean, we should, I look at us as being very similar to, the medical profession where, do no further harm. If it's possible to do that, then we're really obliged to do that. I still to this day don't teach people how to fight. If people come to my martial arts class and my studio and they want to learn how to fight, I send them up the road. There's a lot of people who do that way better than I do. I'll teach them how to live, but I've never really kind of been into that. I think I think at your core you've really got to want to help people. you know, and not hurt them. And that was always my goal. Even when arresting the most violent of offenders, within my nature, there is no malice there to do anybody any harm. You know, if I have to, I will, of course. If I need to defend myself or my partner, or, you know, they up their level of aggression, yeah, I'll match that and I'll go further. But certainly I think at your heart and core, we should be helping to save life, not, you know, not training to take it. I think if you're training in those striking arts, you know, punching and kicking and, you know, and they certainly have a place, but, you know, you can get very, very good at the wrong thing. And, you know, there's nothing looks worse on CCTV than, you know, two or three big haymakers coming in. It's terrible on every level. And the amount of assaults that I investigated as a police officer where, you know, 99 out of 100 times, the offender would, you know, break their knuckles. They'd have, you know, parts of the victim's teeth in their knuckles and things. You know, they'd be sued for $10,000 to replace their veneers. And then all of a sudden there's the bloodborne pathogen disease issue.
Yeah, absolutely. It's it's an interesting thing, right? I mean, it's striking is you know, it's part of martial arts, right? We shouldn't neglect it. But I think when it's your default response to every situation, it becomes problematic, especially when you are in a role where you have a greater duty of care, and where you have, you know, to be honest, a security guard controlling someone, a bouncer controlling someone, evicting someone, that's not a self-defense situation, right? In a lot of the time, we're initiating the contact. We should, if we're strategically sound, have stacked the odds in our favor. We should be more sober, more vigilant. We've got teams, we've got plans. We know where we're going. We know what we're doing. We've used a little bit of an element of surprise. We've approached the person when they're on their own, not when they're with a group of 15, right? We're doing all these things that should be stacking the odds in our favor so we don't have to punch them, right? Different if you're ambushed, right? If you're ambushed and you're literally fighting for your survival, as I have been a couple of times, do what you need to do. But I think sometimes it becomes this, because either people don't have a skill set or that they're not comfortable with the skill set of control and restraint other than physical force, which, you know, then you go so far until you meet someone who you're not stronger than. Sometimes you see, unfortunately, people that just have never dealt with that before, and they're just being flailed around the room because they're so desperately trying to get a wrist lock on someone who has been, you know, throwing around sheets of roofing iron for the last 30 years, and it's just not going to work, right? That wrist isn't going to bend. It doesn't bend for him. It's not going to bend for you. You know, when those sort of situations happen, you see people get this critical focus on the one technique and they end up getting hurt because they can't adapt. They've never dealt with it and they're in panic. And that's one panic response. It's the freeze response. But there's also the panic response of, oh shit, I'm not prepared for this. I need to start swinging. And people start throwing punches, which, yeah, arguably a fight response is better than a freeze response. But what inevitably happens, especially in a crowded club environment, if we're going to use that context, is that it looks really bad. Right? And immediately anyone who turns their head to see what the commotion is sees a security guard punching somebody who always looks like the victim. Right, especially if you're bigger or you look mean or whatever, that the other party always looks like the victim because no one ever sees the start of the confrontation, only the end of it. And now you end up, instead of dealing with one person or three people, you're now dealing with 12 people who all think you're the bad guy, and it just looks bad. So I think while it's important that we have those skill sets, it's also very important that we're incredibly judicious about when we actually enact them. And basically, like, it's not going to get worse, so I may as well use it, right? But yeah, it's rough, and we see this all the time with to bring it out of the security context, even in policing. The second a police officer starts punching or starts dropping knees or starts doing anything that seems excessive, it's going to be recorded, it's going to be uploaded, it's going to be investigated. There's going to be all the stuff that's going to happen because. Usually it's because of a panic, I think. It's because someone is losing control, the ego is getting involved, they're starting to fear, not necessarily for their safety, but just for the perception. How often have we seen unfortunate situations where officers have been trying to restrain someone who's only passively resisting, who is just, the officers are actually working against each other because both of them are pulling in different directions, they can't affect a takedown, or they can't get hands into a handcuff position, and they start punching or kicking because they just they're humiliated. Like they feel embarrassed, they feel threatened, and then they overreact. So one of the things that I like about your book is that you actually talk before you get to the technique section. And my favorite part of books like this, Defensive Tactics for Security Professionals on Amazon. Oh, let me just get there. There it is. There's the money shot. But my favorite part about any book like this is the preamble before the techniques. It's about all the decision-making that's go into choosing the right technique. And one of the things that I really like about your book is that you go into great lengths about managing stress and about thinking clearly through your options, use of force considerations. Talk to me a little bit about how you've gone about communicating that from the other side. So you had a law enforcement career, you come back into the security industry. Has that given you a different perspective when it comes to training security guards?
Yeah, look, it certainly has. I think it was different going into law enforcement from a security background. As you mentioned previously, I had an appreciation of what that job entails. Unfortunately, I think there is still a stigma around security guards. They are sometimes looked down upon from law enforcement, and I think most of the time it's unrightfully so. It is a tough job that they're doing minimal training, minimal support, and it can be a terrifying environment. So certainly when I moved into law enforcement, I had an appreciation of that. Then coming at the outside, leaving law enforcement, back into the security industry, I guess, a little older, a little wiser, and taking all those skills with me as well. I don't think they can be underemphasized, those communication skills, conflict resolution skills. I think should be at the forefront of anyone's training.
The conflict resolution and verbal de-escalation training is something that obviously I talk about a lot. I teach it a lot, but my observation is it's very different de-escalating someone when you come from a position of authority, like you're actually wearing a police uniform, versus you're coming from a position of really no authority. Taking it out of a club environment, because not every security works in a club, obviously. But if you're just wearing a regular security uniform at a grocery store, or at in a loss prevention role, you have no real authority. And the people that are actually going to be your problem children, the ones you're going to deal with, they know you have no authority. So you have to de-escalate in a different way. Was that your experience in terms of moving from a civilian role to a law enforcement role and back to civilian? Did you have to change the way you communicate with people?
Look, I think certainly, as a security officer, you have to probably be a little bit more patient. You have time. You're employed at a venue until 3 a.m. So you're not going anywhere. You have time where, the police are spread quite thin. You might have, two officers, patrolling a huge area with jobs holed up in the list, and, they've got to keep moving. So, you didn't have that element of time, I guess, to develop rapport. But certainly I think at a core level, the skills are much the same. Certainly in law enforcement, you're dealing with a large percentage of the population who don't respect your authority anyway. So whilst you might have it, it really means nothing when you're communicating with these people, because they don't respect that authority anyway. So it's I kind of feel like that puts you back on a similar level as far as one human communicating to another. I think it all the skills of developing empathy and active listening and all the body language skills, I think are all quite the same. I think if you can drill down and kind of get to the why a person is behaving the way they're behaving, or why they're upset, or even get to that why, then you're taking steps in the right direction to solving a problem for that person. And I think if you can certainly solve a problem for that person, why wouldn't you?
And that's a fantastic attitude to have. And I think a lot of the law enforcement verbal de-escalation or conflict management trainers that I've had over the years, or that I've interviewed, those that do it really well are very interested in those human factors of how do I help this person? How do I help this person who is having withdrawing from a substance, or this person who's under a tremendous emotional duress because whether it's a domestic violence situation or they're homeless or there's instability or there's a mental health condition, like whatever it is that's going on, how do I help this person through this? How do I connect them with the right service? How do I convince them that I'm not trying to harm them, that I'm not trying to take away their freedom unnecessarily? Those that do it really well have that very strong human connection. And I think sometimes what I've seen with non-specialist police that come out and try to do conflict management is that they haven't really thought about it. How someone who doesn't have the or else attack, like you've got a belt full of or else, right? So if verbal de-escalation fails, I have contingency B, C, D through F, right? It's all right there. And if that gets overwhelmed, then I have a radio that calls for a whole lot more or else that comes later, right? So sometimes you don't have to develop the de-escalation skills as well because you can kind of get away with it. Whereas if we're training a service worker, even leaving a security guard for the minute, if we're training a service worker who has no or else, whose or else is a good 20 minutes away, then they really need to come back to those human factors of how do we solve problems and how do we acknowledge someone's emotion and how do we help them through whatever the situation is, you know, without making anything more dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. I know when I first moved into law enforcement, you know, we were told, you know, you ask them, you tell them, and then you make them.
Yep.
And that's, you know, I can sort of see where that's spawned from. But on the same note, you know, how long do you ask them for? You know, is there a time limit attached to that request? You know, sometimes I've spent 20 or 30 minutes asking somebody to do something because I've had that time to give them. You know, I think we have to remember that, you know, we're seeing people at their worst, in their worst day, possibly of their life. And, you know, we've all had bad days. We've all had moments where we feel like our world's going to end and you know, whether we've been hit with terrible news or something hasn't gone our way. We've all experienced what that feels like to have a bad day, right?
Mm.
And I think we really need to remember that, you know, this person is having a bad day also. You know, so I think certainly that human element has to come into play. I was fortunate to I guess kind of had this emphasised by trainer Lieutenant Kevin Dillon from the police lockup system. I was attending training in Minnesota, and he quite clearly turned to the audience and said, "Look, you know, it's great to have an angled bladed body position when you're dealing with people and stuff, but there's times when you need to turn towards a person and face them and have a face-to-face conversation. Tell them, look, behind this badge is a heart, and you know, and I can relate to what you're saying." So, you know, if it's tactically and operationally safe and sound to do that, you know, we've got to still be able to connect with people on a human level, regardless of what patch we have on our shoulder.
Mm-hmm. The element of taking time with people is really important. I think from my viewpoint and looking back at the security industry in Australia, I think we need to spend more time. We need to spend more time on everything, right? There's never enough time to prepare someone for all the reality in a practical, you know, time frame. People aren't getting paid to go through an academy, so you can't say, "Hey, you need to train for 6 months to take this lowly paid security guarding job." But at the same time, we do need to spend more time on those human factors. We need to make sure we have people communicating with some level of empathy, that they understand that, yeah, the person who's shoplifting isn't always just a rat bag who's just doing it for fun. There could be someone who's shoplifting literally for survival, yeah, you know, or for, yeah, you know, and then there might be a lot of embarrassment and humiliation that comes with being confronted about that. You could have someone, yeah, you know, I worked in hospital security, right? No one's having a good time at 2 a.m. in an emergency department. So you're going to deal with people that have all sorts of issues. You may even inherit baggage from their previous interactions with police if you happen to have a police-like uniform. So I had that because in hospitals, our uniform was literally from the same supplier as the Queensland Police uniforms. So the only thing that was different was the emblem on our shoulders. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if someone just came in after a knockdown drag out with the police where they were dragged away from their spouse and they've had, yeah, they've got a rap sheet, like, you know, that's longer than their medical records. And then they meet us, their immediate connection is more police. So we inherited the baggage that came from that, even though we didn't care what they'd done. Like, as long as they were nice to the nurses, that's really all that we cared about.
Yep.
But there's so many pieces of that security puzzle where you don't have the backup. You don't have most security guards don't, or in this country, don't even carry batons and handcuffs. Certainly no firearms. So there's a lot of pieces to that puzzle where we have to make our guards more emotionally adept at being able to handle those conflict situations responsibly, effectively, without creating undue problems. But also physically adept, physically fit, physically strong, physically able to manage those situations, because the training gap is huge, and we're never going to be able to train them enough on the job. So they're either going to need to invest in themselves outside of work, like you and I both did with training, or find positions where they don't need those skills. But it's huge, and I think that's one of the main reasons that I'm so happy you wrote this book, Defensive Tactics for Security Professionals, because for those of us out there, and unfortunately it is the minority of the industry. It's a transient industry; people come and go all the time. But for those of us out there that have committed to making this a career, there aren't a lot of resources that are geared towards the security profession. There's a lot of law enforcement stuff, which is very useful. I just had Mark Morales on, who was a co-author of the book with Lauren Christensen, Defensive Tactics, one of my favorite textbooks on defensive tactics. But there's a bit of mental gymnastics that's required to adapt that from a predominantly US policing model to an Australian security industry model. And I think what you've done with this book, and I'll give you a chance to talk about the impetus behind the book, but I think what you've done with this book is you've really done a great job of bridging that gap between some of the high level training that's available for law enforcement officers, especially with the training you've done in the US and the training you've delivered for New South Wales Police, to the private security industry, and putting it in security industry terminology and mapping across your own experiences. And I think that's hugely valuable to the industry as a whole.
Yeah, thank you, Joe. I wanted to write the book to, it was targeted predominantly for the security industry, but also wanted it to have value to, your law enforcement officer or your correctional officer or your nurse or, just your average civilian that wants to feel a little bit safer. I wanted them to be able to relate to what was in the book as well. So it was it was filling a gap. There wasn't something in the Australian, that specifically targeted the Australian security industry. So it certainly was to try and fill that void, but I also wanted to kind of make it flexible enough that others could draw something from it as well.
Absolutely. And look, I think it's, we mentioned offline, one of the things I really liked about your approach in terms of the actual physical techniques, because I know there's a lot of people that are waiting to hear about techniques, right? I went through this evolution, right? And I'll just share my experience, and feel free to add your own. But I went through this evolution where I was fairly naive to what would actually work in real violence before I started working in clubs. I'd grappled, I'd been a wrestler, I'd done judo, I'd done a few bits and pieces that gave me some skill set, but I'd never really applied it against an angry person trying to bottle me. So I kind of just went with the assumption that whatever the security trainers were teaching me was what was going to work. And then when the reality is I did 10 reps of that, and then 3 months later was put into a violent situation and asked to practice it, asked to actually do it. And of course it didn't work, right? That technique didn't work. So I defaulted to what did work for me in the past, which was picking people up and throwing them on the ground. I was lucky that was my skill set, not Muay Thai, because I would have just started elbowing people and that came later. But it was something that I kind of immediately threw out the baby with the bathwater and going, well, wrist locks don't work, or these control and restraint techniques, they don't work, they're rubbish. And it actually was Jim Armstrong, who I know we both know. I went to train with Jim a couple of actually many years ago now, and he had this group of guys together that were training. They're all black belts in other arts. And he'd created this amazing little melting pot of martial artists that had an open mind. And he was predominantly a combatives guy. And they were working on wrist locks that month. And I was like, why are you guys doing wrist locks? And Jim said to me, as only Jim can, he said, if the technique didn't work, it wouldn't have lasted this long. We've just forgotten how to teach it. we've forgotten how to apply it, what the context is. Like, we've just sort of made it this thing where we do it statically and it doesn't work because we've forgotten how it was actually supposed to be applied in the first place. Mm-hmm. So what I love about your book is that you still have the traditional techniques. You still have a lot of things that have been adapted from Japanese jiu-jitsu and aikijitsu and arts like that. But you've also blended in the combat sports approach of having a lot more wrestling stuff, a lot more gross motor skill stuff. I guess probably is the final discussion point for the main interview. I'm curious about your evolution in terms of embracing those sort of gross motor skills, and also what sort of training time do you think the security guards should be investing in getting better at those skill sets if they are working in more hostile environments like the hospitality industry?
Yeah, look, that's a great question, Joe. I think, the quality of training certainly plays a part. As we spoke about before, you can get very, very good at doing the wrong thing. So I think it needs to be training that specifically, is transferable to the skill set that particular officer needs. I've always been very, very particular on, teaching concepts and principles rather than techniques. I think techniques can fail where concepts and principles are generally fairly sound. So, students within my own classes will be able to attest to this, and I openly tell them, I don't want you to do this the way that I do it. I want you to do it how it works for you. So kind of, here's the ingredients, but go cook yourself, So I don't get tight bogged down in the details like some systems do where, your foot has to be 23 and a half degrees angled to the left and you need to grab them with these two fingers here. And, I think that's the least important part. I think being able to understand, the principles that make that work, very, very simple things that you learn in certainly, a lot of martial arts, things like relative positioning and the way that a joint works. You can bend, fold, or twist it. Body positioning, two points of contact, leverage. All these things I think are far more important than the actual techniques themselves. I mean, you look at a wrist lock. How many ways can you do a wrist lock? There's, I can think of dozens that I can demonstrate on ways to do a wrist lock. But ultimately, if you have pressure and counter pressure, and then you have, a level of pain compliance there, that then leads to compliance from that person, your wrist lock was successful.
Mm.
So does it really matter how you applied that wrist lock? As long as it was done safely, you achieved the objective that you wanted to, I don't really care which position you have the hand. I think that's the least important part. So that's why all those tactics I put at the back of the book, they're just, they're a template, a skeleton to use. My wish for people is that they go and make them their own, absorb them into their existing skill set, make them work for them, because what works for me might not work for, a 50 kilogram female officer or somebody that, has other things happening. So it has to work for the individual, and they need to have the freedom to be able to adapt those tactics and techniques to work for them, because if it won't work for them, it's useless. So I guess to kind of answer your question, what time frame do I think is appropriate for people to learn these? It's different for every person. I don't think you can put a time limit on it. I've taught seminars, that have gone for days, and I've taught sessions that have been as little as half an hour. Not to say that the person who I taught for half an hour didn't gain as much as a person did for 2 hours. So I guess it depends on the student, how quickly they can pick up and retain information, their level of interest, their background in training, their reasons for wanting to be put in harm's way initially. I think all these factors come into play when training a student, certainly in the law enforcement circles. And I know it's similar in the military because there's so many time restraints. We do this full immersion training. So you'll go and do a week course here or a weekend course there and pack as much as you can into that time frame to utilize the time, which I think is also wonderful. You can train one night a week for an hour all year, or you can go and do a full 2 weeks in a row. I don't think time really has a great deal to do with the quality of the learning or the quality of the retention that the student is gaining. Obviously, there's a level of repetition that needs to occur with that student, but I think that comes down to the training process, how that training is delivered and then tested, on the tail end of that.
Yeah, absolutely. My closing comment on that, and I'm sure you'll echo it, is if you're involved in the security industry, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about Australia or anywhere else. If you're involved in the industry and you are committed to being part of the industry and you're committed to sticking around, and it's not, you know, and no judgment if you're not. I mean, it's not for everybody. Please invest in yourself. Please actually go out and get good at this, because even if you're working in a role where you don't deal with it on a regular basis, you don't deal with violence on a regular basis, that's probably even more dangerous, because when it does happen, you're not going to have the reps. You're not going to have the experience. You're not going to be able to read the situation as well if you don't train. You need to make sure that you are ready, because those situations, it only takes one to change your life. It only takes one for it to go really bad, where you can get hurt or you can go to jail, or you can lose your license, or you can lose the ability to feed your family if you don't manage that situation the way that that you should. So it's unfortunately we don't, the industry in Australia is such that most employers aren't going to invest in you. Most employers are not going to send you to a 2-week training seminar to get better at stuff, right? They don't have the resources to do that. They don't have the profit margins to do that. We're working in a different space to law enforcement or military, where they can go, where we can sometimes get sent to courses. You need to do that for yourself. And even the best law enforcement officers like yourself that I know that that are serious about it, they use their own dime and their own leave to go train, to go get better at the job. That's my encouragement to security guards everywhere, is don't think just because you did your 2 weeks or your 4 weeks or whatever it is that you did to get licensed, that's where your training stops. If you want to be serious about this and you want to stick with this industry, you need to keep investing in yourself, get as skilled as you possibly can. It'll help your career progression, but it's also like paying for your insurance to make sure that you prevent that nasty situation from happening as much as possible.
Sorry, Joe, I think I lost you there for a moment.
Yeah, all good, mate. We just had a little bit of a freeze, but that's all good. I'll edit that out.
Yeah, certainly to echo what you're saying. Yeah, these are perishable skills. I think something I've certainly learned, is the more that I learn, the less that I know. It's no different to any other skill. It's probably vastly more important than any other skill, and it could save your life. But it's no different to any other skill. If you wanted to go and learn how to play golf or drive a race car or any skill, you need to put in the time, And as soon as you stop putting in that time, you could expect to not be on the top any longer. And in this game, in security and law enforcement, we need to be at the top all the time. We need to be at the tip of the spear. And, something that's thrown around a lot is this world's best practice. Mm. Continually challenging that notion of what is world's best practice, because training's evolving all the time as well. So whilst we've been fighting since we were Neanderthals, there's only so many ways to punch and kick a person. Training concepts and methodologies change all the time. So I think if you're not out there actively seeking out that training and seeking out that knowledge, you're really doing those you protect a disservice, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely agreed, Matt. All right, that's a great conversation. Nick, your book is Defensive Tactics for Security Professionals. It's available on Amazon anywhere in the world if you're interested in grabbing a copy. Nick, just give you a quick plug. Your martial arts academy for anyone who's local and wants to train with you?
Yeah, Blue Warrior Martial Arts here in Kurri. Please contact me and come on down and have a look.
Absolutely. All right, Nick, thanks very much. You're gonna hang around and do some bonus questions with us in just a second. But for those leaving us here, thank you very much, Mr. Nick Wyborn.
Thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
All right, what a great chat that was with Nick. Thoroughly enjoyed catching up with an old friend and having a chat about his book. You can grab his book, Defensive Tactics for Security Professionals, on Amazon. The link will be in the show notes. That's it for today, and I look forward to talking to you next time.